Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It is day four of the government shutdown, and this is obviously getting wall-to-wall media attention. But who's going beyond the predictable he said and he said coverage? And who's reporting on the actual role of government? There's also a lot of confusion out there. A lot of people are, they don't really know what's shut down, what's open. So who's giving a good overview of what's actually happening and when all of this might end? Dave Leventhal has been covering the shutdown. He's got a piece about politicians on both sides of the aisle taking advantage of the shutdown by raising political cash. He writes, quote, "No matter that most every headline today is shouting about disappearing money, legions of Democrats and Republicans alike are trying to cash in politically on the turbulence. They are sending supporters a lot of messages urging them to open their wallets." Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, where he leads the Source Project, investigating the influence of money in politics. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you.
Great to have you. And the first presidential phone conversation between the United States and Iran since 1979 took place last Friday. Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, was in New York attending the UN's General Assembly. Unlike his predecessor, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Rouhani got a very warm reception from the U.S. media, and he's currently on the cover of Time magazine. So with Iran's nuclear program front and center, how are the media covering this new relationship? Joining us to talk about coverage is Laura Secker. She's an independent journalist who covers Iran's politics and culture for The New Yorker, and she's currently writing a book on Iran. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the show. Do we have Laura?
Yes.
Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Dave, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
There was a great story in the Washington City paper, a local paper here in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, but it had to do with a different type of shutdown than the one that we're typically talking about these days, and it's the shutting down of group homes that are politically oriented in the district. There's very few left, and Siddhartha Mahanta of the Washington City paper wrote just a brilliant, probably 4,000 or 5,000 word article that really detailed the trials and tribulations of one of the last types of politically oriented group homes still in operation here in the district.
What is a group home?
A group home is a place that's sort of like a collective where people who are like-minded or just put together and group together because of shared economic interests will live together and share responsibilities in a single home, sort of like a big extended family, but not everyone will necessarily know each other. And in this particular home that people had been living on, that the article is all about, it's really all about the struggles that they have living as people of not very significant means in the midst of a very, very fancy neighborhood, one that's really on the economic upswing, and yet they're just trying to hold on and still stay in business, so
wow.
to speak.
That's a great story. How many people typically live in these group homes?
It can be anywhere from a handful to maybe 15 or 20, depending on the size of the property.
And so they're politically oriented.
Yes, these are people, again, very like-minded and unabashed socialists in this case, and they're very proud of their political leanings, and they feel like they're doing great work together and that they're sharing in their collective experience, but they're also being priced out of the neighborhood in
wow.
a way, so they face some struggles of their own.
It's kind of refreshing to hear that that still exists, especially in a place like Washington.
Oh, it's a great read, no matter what you think of them. It's a very human story as well.
All right. Well, thank you. So we'll find that story and put a link on our website right after the show. And what about you, Laura? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, you know, as you know, I think the subject of Iran, and there's been so much happening within and about Iran in the last couple of weeks, we tend to see a lot more punditry and commentary than we do reporting. So to me, what's been interesting to watch has been the work of the reporters who are actually still functioning within Iran for the Western press, and that's not an easy position to occupy. And there are two in particular who I thought to highlight. Jason Rezaian of the Washington Post and Thomas Erbrink of the New York Times have been writing for high-profile publications while during one of the most difficult periods for reporters under the Islamic Republic. And I thought that Thomas had an excellent piece last week. Well, actually, it was just a couple of days ago, September 30th, in the New York Times that was about the impact of sanctions on the Iranian economy. And what I thought that this piece did well, you know, we have a lot of confusion about the state of the Iranian economy because the troubles that have plagued it did not begin with the latest round of sanctions. We've had about 7 or 8 years under former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad where there was runaway inflation and widespread complaints about unemployment. And these things became sort of folded into the generalized complaint about the impact of sanctions after 2012. I thought this piece did a good job of isolating the impact of sanctions by looking at the chain of supply for a particular businessman. He spent time with a guy who runs a factory that makes buses, and he looked at how this man was managing to move goods and money over state lines under the current sanctions regime, which is really one of the most intense that we've ever known. And I thought it was kind of a nice case study that didn't look at the sort of generalized economic malaise, but said, so what do you do when you have to go to suppliers who have every incentive not to be dealing with a business partner from Iran, and when you have to move money in cash over borders, and when you have basically no recourse, the goods that you import turn out to be duds. Mm-hmm. So this guy, we're sort of looking at a sort of micro level, somebody who says he's employing 100 workers in a town with no jobs and trying to keep his business alive. And so this Thomas Erbrink put this into the frame of the sort of the larger economic picture in Iran and what it means for Iran to be grappling with the long-term impact of the sanctions regime.
And in that story, an oil expert said that exports have been reduced by about 50% because of the sanctions.
Yeah, that was anticipated. And in some ways, we can more easily grasp what that means for an oil-producing country like Iran that is a sort of classic rentier state that has relied almost 80% of its revenues at a certain point were from oil. What's harder to grasp and more ultimately devastating from what I'm hearing is the impact of financial sanctions, because even what Iran can sell, it can't bring money in for. So there's a sense that the freezing up of those transactions has ultimately had a more biting and profound effect on the Iranian economy and on ordinary business people who are not in the oil sector.
And it can't conduct any trade, and it's not part of the global banking system?
That's right.
What about average people?
Well, this trickles down, and that's one of the things that I thought was suggested nicely in the Erdbrink piece, that you have, you know, a guy who has a factory that makes buses is not a major business owner in Iran, but he, in a town where his factory workers live, if he shuts his factory, that has a tremendous impact on probably the economy of the entire town. So, yes, this comes down to the level of the way ordinary people live their lives and where they find their livelihoods. And in Iran, you know, there are a lot of interesting and difficult economic questions that kind of get tangled up together. But Iran is a country that has a problem with its middle class. And at least in my reporting over there, I've been struck by the fact that in some ways the people who are least well-served by the economic structure of the state are middle-class people.
And because you brought up sanctions, Laura, have reporters asked the Obama administration to justify a continuation of the sanctions? And do you think now that there's the possibility of a new relationship, will this change?
I think that's a question as much for Congress as for President Obama. We have a sanctions regime that is partially imposed, not by executive order. And that's going to be a real issue. We've seen a lot of commentary in the last week from concerned foreign policy experts and Iran experts asking, well, if we don't have some unity on our side about what the sanctions are for and under what conditions we are willing or able to alleviate them, then our negotiating position is going to be hurt.
And that is Laura Secor. She's an independent journalist who covers Iran's politics and culture for The New Yorker. And we're going to continue talking about coverage of the new relationship between Iran and the United States for about 10 more minutes. So this got a lot of attention, the fact that there was the first presidential phone conversation between the U.S. and Iran since 1979. It took place last Friday. It got headlines. What really struck you about this coverage? Where are you seeing good reporting on this? And Where are you seeing in-depth reporting? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're also joined by Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And Dave, I know this is not your area of expertise, but you are in Washington, and this did get so much attention over the week. What really struck you, just based on the headlines that you saw?
What struck me in particular is that the headlines began to get buried and buried deeper and deeper in many papers and websites, particularly as we're talking about Iran. It's amazing what will happen when you have a week like the week that we've had here in Washington, D.C., where you had three major news flashpoints. Of course, the government shutdown, then you had the rollout of Obamacare, and then just yesterday you had the shooting of a person at the U.S. Capitol. So in a way, with a news week like this, you've got headlines trumping headlines trumping headlines, and something such as international affairs writ large, and specifically about Iran, at least in the conversation here in D.C., as I talked with some fellow reporters, my colleagues here at the center, Iran was not the topic at the forefront of our minds, even though in many of their minds, even though there had been such major developments that had occurred, and arguably the thawing of relations with the regime that, of course, largely over the past 30 years, has not been speaking with the United States in any regular way. So it's a very fickle town here, oftentimes, where just the latest thing that comes up or the issue of the moment is really the thing that is going to be at the forefront of the conversation. And it does sort of speak sort of to in a larger way to the crisis-to-crisis type of operation here of the government in D.C., where just the thing that is hottest at the moment is the one that everyone is paying attention to.
Well, and Laura, how significant is this, the fact that President Obama and President Rouhani actually had a conversation on the phone last Friday?
I think it's tremendously significant in a symbolic way. I mean, I'm sure that the content of the phone conversation, which we don't really know the contours of, notwithstanding, what's significant is the fact of it, and the fact of Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif speaking at length with American Secretary of State John Kerry. Symbolically, this is a thaw that's been unprecedented for the last 30 years. And, you know, one thing that has really occurred to me as I've been watching the reception of these events both here and in Iran is that the non-relationship between the United States and Iran, not the actual sources of hostility between the two countries, but the fact of not speaking about them has been a political decision both here and there, and the undoing of it is going to take some fancy political footwork both here and there. That these are, in a way, these are domestic issues more than they are issues in international relations. So we've seen Obama having to answer to his right flank, and Rouhani having to answer to his, simply in order to have this exchange of words on the telephone. And that's just the show of the will to do that is significant. And I think most importantly, from the Iranian side, the demonstration that it's not just a president who has a reformist vision who's reaching out trying to mend relations. This is a president who doesn't have a particularly reformist vision, but who does have the endorsement of the hard line, including the supreme leader in Iran. This is an official and unified effort to a degree that we really haven't seen. This is demonstrated by the fact that even the hardest of the hardline press in Iran has largely either stayed quiet or expressed approval for Rouhani's outreach.
Well, and that's the other thing is in your New Yorker piece, you write about some of the changes that have happened since Rouhani became president. You write that normally blocked websites, including but not limited to Facebook and Twitter, emerged from behind government filters for just a couple of hours, officially called a technical glitch, but possibly might be a trial run for future censorship relaxation. The government set free 11 political prisoners who had been held since the unrest that followed the 2009 presidential election.
Actually, 80 now.
80? Oh, 80 have been released. Because we've done a lot of shows about just the torture and people in jail. What else, what other changes do you expect and what do people expect?
That is a tricky question because, you know, I like to say Iran, it's a moment where people, especially people who are invested in the story of the Islamic Republic and the question of democratization in Iran, are very hopeful right now. And it's always a little bit frightening when hopes are elevated because they've often been dashed. And we saw that under President Khatami, who really came in with an explicit program of liberalization and was stymied at every turn. So it's, in a way, the bigger question even than this question of foreign relations, which the Rouhani team seems to have the endorsement of its higher-ups to take on, is the question of liberalization inside the country, whether or not we're going to see an increased toleration of political dissent, whether the release of political prisoners is a gesture toward a larger loosening of the atmosphere, which has become heavily securitized. I cannot overemphasize the degree to which the last 4 years were really a new thing in the Islamic Republic. It was an atmosphere of very heavy clampdown. So this Rouhani has come in pledging to improve that situation. Are we going to see it rolled back to where it was in 2009, which would be an improvement, but frankly, a modest one? Or are we going to see it pushed forward into a sphere that maybe Khatami had hoped to see it pushed into? We don't know that. And I think there's a danger of there's always a sort of question of whether the hopes are going to get ahead of what anybody in the political sphere can deliver, because when that has happened in the past, it's often produced tensions and difficulties for even the people who are in the position to effect change.
And the 80 political prisoners, we should note, have not been named, right?
Some of them have. Honestly, I should double-check those figures and those names for you. But
okay. And Dave, do you have any questions for Laura before we let her go?
Well, I would be very interested to find out if you think that, particularly in light of President Obama canceling his foreign trip over this weekend, if international issues, Iran or otherwise, are going to stay in the national conversation at a time when, of course, this major event took place by anyone's measure with Iran just a week ago.
You're absolutely right that we have a culture that tends to focus on the latest breaking story, and there is sort of a danger of this fading from view. On the other hand, I've wondered as you were talking, I was thinking, is this really the worst thing? Because to some degree, maybe taking the pressure off of it is helpful until actually negotiations are able to get underway and we see what they can yield. But I think it sure doesn't look good for the United States overseas to be at war with itself. It doesn't generate a lot of confidence. But I guess we wait and see.
All right. And Laura, we just have a quick question from Todd who wrote in. I'd like to know why Israel's nukes are a non-subject and the fact that these sanction programs always hurt the average citizens the most while the elites are just fine. And it is interesting because in almost every story I've heard, Iran's nuclear program is still front and center despite this phone call and this possible new relationship.
Well, the latest Iran story is about the nuclear program. I don't think there's any mistake about that. President Rouhani came in with a mandate to attempt to resolve a nuclear file with the West because this is what is choking the country's economy. And I don't think, I guess I'm not quite sure I understand the question to that degree because while it is, I agree, tiresome from the point of view of a reader or even a writer to be reading incessantly about this question of the nuclear program when Iran is a country that has a great deal more to offer by way of interesting and important stories that are happening within it and around it. That is the story this last couple of weeks. Mm. We're looking at, I don't even know if the Rouhani team is looking at opening a broader negotiation than just about the nuclear program, but we know that it's the nuclear program that is coming up for discussion and that is the source of this outreach. And that's because of the sanctions regime.
All right. Well, we're going to take one more caller for you, and then we'll say goodbye, Laura, if that's all right. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a good program, as usual. I have a quick question. I read the article in the New York Times, and the subtext of it is that the economy is on the verge of collapse. I don't know if you guessed, covered that. I may have missed some of that. But that's my question. How bad are things in Iran? And then one quick comment. The great article I read early this morning was an article that appeared in Le Monde in France about the passing of General Giap. He died when he was 102 years old. a beautiful article about his leadership as a top general in the Vietnamese army and the defeat of the French at Dien Bien Phu was covered in great detail. Thank you very much. I'll stop here.
Okay, thank you, Max. We'll put that article on our website right after the show.
The caller is right that the article did suggest that the Iranian economy is on the verge of collapse. I can't speak to that because I was last there a year and a half ago, and there are very often predictions of the collapse of the Iranian economy that do not come true. The Iranian economy has a lot of underpinnings that are stronger than one might think. It's not, you know, this is a large country with a lot of resources. I don't know if it's on the verge of collapse. I do know or suspect from what I hear from over there that it's facing a very, very serious strain. And it's a country that is, it's a largely middle-class country. It's a country that's used to a standard of living that is under threat right now. So there's been a lot of debate among the community of people who watch and debate about Iran over whether or not the outreach of the Rouhani team reflects a sense of crisis on the economic front on account of the sanctions. I think it's pretty clear that there is a mounting sense of crisis and a sense of urgency to get the sanctions undone. On the other hand, I think it's important to remember that the sanctions would not have the impact that they had if the economy hadn't already been in a fragile state. So I don't know about collapse. I don't even really know what that means. But I do think that there is a sense that that the country can't go on as it is right now for very much longer.
And Laura, we have just about a minute to break. You were there last year. When do you plan to go back? And what is it like to be a foreign journalist working in Iran? Do you anticipate any major changes under the new president?
I sure hope so. I was there a year and a half ago, and it was the most constrained trip I had ever made to Iran. I've been there 5 times, and with each visit, the visas get shorter and the level of control has gotten more uncomfortable. The last visit was really something else. It was something that I don't think anyone had seen since the revolution, where they had foreign correspondents on buses being driven around, and there was a sense that we really didn't have much freedom of movement at all. I know that there is an expressed intention on the part of this new administration to loosen those restrictions and to bring foreign correspondents back in. I keep my hopes relatively modest because I know that even under the reformist regime, it was not it's not like a country that you can walk into and expect to just execute your vision of how you want to report your story. There's always a sense that you are under some degree of surveillance and management.
And when do you plan to go back?
When they grant me a visa.
Well, keep us informed because we'd love to have you on when you return.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Laura. That is Laura Sekar. She's an independent journalist who covers Iran's politics and culture for The New Yorker. She's currently writing a book on Iran. You can find her stories at yourcallradio.org. We just got an email from Leslie who says, yesterday, all of the right wingers were accusing President Obama of negotiating with the Iranians, the Syrians, and the Russians, but not with House Republicans. Well, maybe he thinks that even the Iranians, Syrians, and Russians are more rational, responsible, and reliable than John Boehner and his teapots. So thank you for the email, Leslie. And after the break, we will be talking about what's happening with the government shutdown. We also got a few emails about healthcare and media coverage of that. And we'll talk about who's going beyond the predictable he said, mostly he said coverage, and who's reporting on the actual role of government. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
All of the stories that you hear featured on the weekly Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. We invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about the Occupy movement 2 years later. What did the movement accomplish, and what is the status of Occupy movements across the country? They're still out there, but they're not getting much media attention. And then on Tuesday, we'll talk about the ride-sharing services and what they might mean for the future of taxis. There's a big debate going on in places like San Francisco. California actually became the first state to regulate the exploding market for ride-sharing services. Cab companies say it's going to destroy their businesses. In fact, cab drivers say that they're already seeing a major decrease in the money they take home. So we'll have a debate about ride sharing and taxi cabs on Tuesday. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are going to talk about the government shutdown, and we'll also talk about the Affordable Care Act. We're joined by Dave Leventhal. He's been covering the shutdown. He's got a really good piece about politicians on both sides of the aisle taking advantage of the shutdown by raising political cash. They're sending emails to citizens saying, this is happening, we need your help, send us money. This is not getting much attention. So we'll talk with Dave about that. And if you'd like to join us, what do you think about the coverage? There's been a lot out there, but who's going beyond the he said, she said, and who's going beyond the very predictable line that this is just business as usual, this is a partisan issue? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And now I would like to welcome Joshua Holland to the show. Josh is senior digital producer at BillMoyers.com and host of Politics and Reality Radio. He's the author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy. Hi, Josh. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
And congrats on your new gig. We haven't had you on since you've been working for BillMoyers.com.
I'm very, very happy to be working with Bill. He's an amazing man.
Yeah, I bet. It must be a great experience. Well, and I love the piece you just wrote for the website about who's going beyond the predictable he said, she said. And you write that with a few notable exceptions, the media have framed with what Jonathan, is it Chait?
Jonathan Chait, yeah.
Chait, called a kind of quasi-impeachment in typical he said, she said fashion, obscuring the fact that the basic norms that govern Congress have been thrown out the window by a small cabal of Tea Party-endorsed legislators from overwhelmingly Republican districts. The media treat unprecedented legislative extortion as typical partisan negotiations, and in doing so, they normalize it. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, you know, we've had many, many ideological and partisan standoffs over budgets, over, you know, various pieces of legislation. And I think that Beltway reporters, ostensibly neutral Beltway reporters, get into a kind of habit of describing these things as, you know, gridlock, standoff, et cetera, et cetera. And what they're failing to note is that this particular episode is really unprecedented, where you have a president in his second term with a signature legislative accomplishment that's been litigated not only in the Supreme Court but through a national election, and a minority party saying, look, we're going to shut down the government and potentially breach the debt limit if you don't. The beginning demand was to defund was the word that they were using, eliminate this law or scale it back significantly. And I think that that's, you know, something that is being lost in that reporting that this is kind of a typical budget standoff. Mm. It's interesting to see that the administration, this has been coming out in a number of stories in the last couple of days, they don't view this as something that they can lose just because of the legislation. They see this as really a fight for maintaining the separation of powers. That is, if they lose this, they think that they'll create a precedent where future presidents can basically have their elections annulled by a minority party.
Well, what are your thoughts on this, Dave? Because the word partisan is in so many headlines about the government shutdown.
We've been focusing very heavy on the political ramifications, the electioneering and election ramifications of this current situation. So, of course, everyone is talking about the legislative aspects, about the government operation aspects of it, too. But there is a very, very strong political aspect, and both parties are very involved in this. Both parties often like to think and will present themselves as sort of the exclusive denizens of the higher ground here. But in reality, they're both prone, and they've both been doing this. They're diving deep into the muck in order to fill their coffers for the next election cycle, to score points off of their opponents, to try to set them up for what's going to be a very, very contentious midterm in 2014, because you have a divided Congress, and both sides, of course, see this as an opportunity to either retain or regain the side of the House or the side of the Congress that they currently do not have right now, which is why we're seeing so many fundraising emails and pitches and come-ons and everything that you can possibly send out to a group of supporters. Both sides are doing it right now, which is, as you mentioned, what we've been writing about a great deal over the past week.
Well, we have a call on fundraising, so let's hear from Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is the most desperate fundraising from Republicans worried about losing in the primary and the Democrats going after the general election in response to the Tea Party, who seems to get a lot of independent financing?
Thank you. Dave?
If I understand the caller's question, it seemed as if he was suggesting that Republicans might be going after Republicans. There is an element to that, and there have been some groups, independent organizations that are conservative in their politics, going after Republicans for, in a way, not being conservative enough. But mainly this has been Democrat versus Republican and Republican versus Democrat, and they're using those both sides as an opportunity to really try to demonize the people who are the most notable folks within the opposite party. So, for example, we got an email a couple days ago from the Republicans, and Barack Obama and Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi were being highlighted as the people who, in the Republicans' opinion, are responsible for shutting down the federal government to protect Obamacare. And then, probably a couple hours later, we got an email from the Democrats, who highlight by name and with very demonic-looking photos Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and Michelle Bachmann. And they're accusing them of saying, well, because they want to prevent 40 million people from gaining affordable, accessible health care, they're the ones who are at fault. So effectively, everyone is reading from the same political playbook here. And again, it just goes back to trying to use this as an opportunity to exploit the news of the day, the situation on the ground, for future political gain.
I was just reading your story, Dave, and I was laughing because the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee says, please contribute $3 right now. The Republican National Committee, please contribute $14 right now. I mean, they're all asking for like $10 and $15.
It's funny you mentioned that, but it seems like the smallest of small potatoes. At the same time, what it effectively allows them to do is they're giving themselves an opportunity to get buy-in. They're giving themselves an opportunity to reach out to people who may not have many means, may not have a whole lot of extra money, but if they donate $3 or $5 or $10, they're providing all of their contact information. That goes into a big database. We wrote about this considerably last year when the Obama campaign, in a very unprecedented and skillful way, was able to create sort of digital dossiers on all of the millions of supporters who came out to support them. And both Republicans and Democrats are really trying to do this because they see this as not only the wave of the future, but what's here in the present right now. If you're going to be successful in political fundraising, political organizing, getting out the vote, rallying your base, then you have to absolutely be very savvy to all the digital tools that you have at your hands and your fingertips. And if you're not going and trying to get more and more people to sign up and participate, whether it's in a direct way and a personal way or a digital online way, then you're really cutting yourselves off at the knees, and you're letting your opponent have a great advantage over you that they wouldn't have otherwise.
And Josh, are you seeing many reports about why this is actually happening? And what, you know, what is really going on here? Why is the government shut down right now? I mean, it's a basic question, but I haven't really seen it answered in very many places.
Well, I mean, it dates back to March. Both chambers, the Republican-controlled House and the Democratic-controlled Senate, passed budgets. And then usually what happens is that they go into conference and they reconcile these budgets. But hardline Republican senators blocked the assignment of conferees so that there could not be a conference. And what they were worried about was that there would be, you know, a likely agreement that comes out of that. So we've been trying to get this continuing resolution, the stopgap budget funding, through. And, you know, basically, since the election, Republican leaders have promised the Tea Party contingent that they were going to fight Obamacare tooth and nail before it could be instituted. And there's a widespread belief among conservative circles, and certainly there was a report out by Democracy Corps, the pollsters this week, saying that they think that if Obamacare goes into effect, it will be popular and it will be impossible to repeal in the future. So they really think that this is a do-or-die moment. The way that they see it is that this will create dependency on the government and make a lot of voters into Democrats.
That is Joshua Holland. He's senior digital producer with BillMoyers.com, host of Politics and Reality Radio, author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, where he leads the Source Project investigating the influence of money in politics. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What really struck you about coverage this week? Do you know how this is affecting you and your community? We just got an email from David who says, as far as what meddling of the budget that a particular party or party member is trying to slash, no reporting is done. Issues about the affordable health care program is chatted about in broad terms. One BBC interviewer referred to the 45 million Americans who do not have insurance as the few people that are uninsured. What was wrong with mentioning a number? Why demean the quality of the interview with a term like a few? I get the impression government subsidized news is always showing their underbelly. Thank you for the email, David. And you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Roberto in Daly City. Hi, Roberto. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. I have something I'd like to say, and then I would like to then ask why this issue is not being presented to the public in this format, because this is what I perceive to be happening. I've long stated that we're going to have and we will need more parties, the multi-party system. And what I see is that a few wealthy individuals have basically seen the same thing. So they've taken the Tea Party over, and they've instituted subterfuge. And what I mean by that is that they've noticed that the separation between the two major parties is only 2-3% at most. They could build an establishment that would be able to control 2-3% of one party's votes. Then they could, in fact, take over that party, because that party will become dependent on them if they want to stay in power. Therefore, the Tea Party is integral to the Republican Party, because without their votes, they wouldn't be able to even envision the 2-3% margin. And they can do this by also selecting one issue, an issue in which they could advocate and get the support, enough support, to be able to institute to win those elections. And now they have what they have. They have 2-3% of one party that they can say, if you don't follow what we tell you and what we demand you to do, you will not be elected, because we have the 3% that can throw an election every time.
Thank you for the call. And I'm glad you bring this up. And I'd like you both to address this. Have you seen much reporting about gerrymandering today? Because I think this is a really important aspect of this story. Politico had a piece about gerrymandering, and it found that Republicans wielded line-drawing power in nearly five times as many districts as Democrats in 2010, producing significantly more districts that are overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly conservative. And then there was another piece in the Cook Political Report found that 79 of the 236 House Republicans serving during the last shutdown resided in districts that President Clinton won in 92. Today, just 17 of the 232 Republicans are in districts that Obama won in 2012. So there's been massive gerrymandering over the last 17 years. Josh, how significant is this, and are you seeing this being reported?
Well, I would caution not to put it all onto gerrymandering. There's something called the kind of natural shuffling going on as well, which has to do with migration patterns. As people move, become more urbanized, what we're seeing is very, very heavily concentrated Democratic districts and cities, and then somewhat Republican districts in abundance in more rural areas. But one of the things that I think is missing when we talk about this as a partisan split, and this gets a little bit to what the caller was talking about, is that it's not really just a partisan fight. There is an intense civil war going on within the Republican Party about how to approach this. The Tea Party is exerting an enormous amount of pressure on leadership to undertake an action that a lot of the Republican leadership themselves think is ultimately counterproductive for the party. So in addition to the fundraising emails between Democrats and Republicans that were discussed a moment ago, I'm getting lots of stuff from the Senate Conservatives Fund, from Heritage Action, attacking fellow Republicans for not being sufficient, in their view, not standing up sufficiently against Obamacare. So there's this real split within the Republican Party. Grover Norquist this week said of Ted Cruz that he had pushed the House into traffic and then walked away. So this is a very important angle of the story that gets missed when we talk about it as just Democrats versus Republicans.
What are your thoughts, Dave?
It's a key element of a story, not only now, but it's going to be an even bigger story, certainly in 2014, when you have the opportunity for Tea Party Republicans to fight against establishment Republicans. We saw a good bit of this in 2012. There were several very, very high-profile primaries, Republican versus Republican, where sitting Republicans ended up losing their offices as a result of having a very strong charge and in opposition from folks who were more conservative than they were, and made a very strong case to the district, to the constituency, that they were in a better place, that they were philosophically more aligned with the electorate than the person who was in there. And I think Richard Murdoch and Dick Lugar in Indiana would be a great example of this in the U.S. Senate race. So fully expect in 2014, like there was a bit in 2012, for there to be a lot of Republican primaries that, number one, aren't just high profile in the sense that somebody is running against an establishment candidate, but there's going to be a lot of money behind that person too. Not only in money that's going to come into his or her own personal campaign account, but outside groups such as is my counterpart to refer to, they're going to come in and they're going to be able to spend significant amounts of money, because in the campaign system that we have right now, you have super PACs, you have nonprofit groups that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money in order to advocate for or against candidates. And that's not just Republicans versus Democrats. It's also Republicans versus Republicans, or in some situations, you can have Democrats versus Democrats, too.
In the New York Times, Paul Krugman, a columnist and economist, wrote, quote, "Coming back to the class warfare issue, my working theory is that wealthy individuals bought themselves a radical right party, believing correctly that it would cut their taxes and remove regulations, but failed to realize that eventually the craziness would take on a life of its own and that the monster they created would turn on its creators as well as the little people," end quote. What are your thoughts on that, Josh?
Well, I think that that's essentially right. I think that, you know, you can't tell a group that you will be able to undo, say, Obamacare. Let's just step back and remember that most of Obamacare spending is mandatory spending, right? Mm-hmm. So there was never any hope when they shut down the government of actually undoing the law. But what they did was they got their base very, very fired up for this process. And in doing so, they backed themselves into a corner where, you know, you can see this in John Boehner. He came out this week and he said, well, I'm not really going to allow a default on the debt. He has been, it seems to me, willing to find some way out, but kind of facing really, really extraordinary pressure from his right flank. And that's a result of the Tea Party movement.
And Dave?
It's very intimidating when you have groups that are very, very firmly entrenched in their beliefs, sort of meeting out a certain orthodoxy. And what that means in electoral terms is you have these super PACs, you have these nonprofit groups that are waving around the specter of, we will come at you with millions or even tens of millions of dollars in your next election unless you do what we want you to do, unless you fight tooth and nail against Obamacare, unless you fight against the Obama administration, A, B, C, D, all the way to Z in terms of their laundry list of issues that they very, very much care about. So if you're one of these members of Congress and you're hearing this, if you're faced with the prospect of being in a district where you could have soft support, where somebody making a run against you from the right would be problematic and you may not necessarily have the resources to compete or it's going to be very difficult, then your thoughts on this may, on all of these situations, expectations may change significantly and precipitously as a result of knowing that that big money is out there and that big money could be used as a weapon against you.
And do you think gerrymandering is significant here?
Gerrymandering is significant in the sense that if you look statistically at districts today versus, say, where they were 20 or 30 years ago, many of them, as we discussed a little while ago, are more blue or more red than they used to be. And that could be something that not only is going to factor into a general election, but very much could factor into primary elections as well if you have somebody making a challenge from the hard left or the hard right against an incumbent.
Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Joshua Holland is senior digital producer at BillMoyers.com. And let's hear next. And if you'd like to join us, 866-798-8255 or feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Hi, Rose. And, you know, immediately upon the initiation of the Affordable Care Act in the last few days, there must be some people who are watching this pretty closely to see if it's having the normal turbulence and ups and downs trying to achieve liftoff, and to what extent some of that might be programmatic. If there may be some people who are attempting denial of service maneuvers to make it harder for the people who legitimately want to use the new insurance exchanges to actually get through. Well, as an illustration, when somebody, one of your guests says that the incoming email brought offers of appeals for support with small money attachments like please send $3 or please send $14 coming from diverse parties, but possibly not the same party. You can't help but wonder if that's not a carefully drawn out maneuver. If that's not a smokescreen, if that's not a cover of some kind to give the appearance of legitimacy to the people who are sending out the email, as if this was the little guys, as if these are people that send $3, $5, $10 because that's all they have, as if we're supposed to believe that there are actually that many of us who are interested in politics at the same time we wish we could get $5. This isn't like a PR campaign that was, and I heard what you were saying before about these individuals, but we don't know which ones they are, but there's somewhere in the murk, there are these individuals who have actually come out and told Tea Party Republicans, so-called, that they can't count on deep pocket support.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, George. Sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time, and we have a few other listeners we want to get to. I did get kudos from Cornelius, who wanted to point out an article in the New York Times yesterday. It's getting a lot of attention. Millions of poor left uncovered by health law. And the lead says, because these people live in states largely controlled by Republicans that have declined to participate in a vast expansion of Medicaid, the medical insurance program for the poor, 8 million Americans who are impoverished, uninsured, and ineligible for help. The government will pay for the expansion through 2016 and no less than 90% cost in later years. Dave, did you see this piece?
I did read the piece, and that was an excellent piece. I think it speaks to the idea that that there are a lot of reporters out there doing very good work who are trying to get a layer or two much deeper into what this all means for individuals on the ground, for people who are just trying to make ends meet. There was a great story in the LA Times by Maeve Reston. She was out in rural Oklahoma talking about how Obamacare and the healthcare rollout is affecting people there, mm-hmm. and also how it's being met with a lot of resistance from a lot of folks as well.
Right. Well, and it just speaks to the problem we have in this country with so many people who are either uninsured or underinsured because millions and millions of people went to these websites to take a look at these plans.
Indeed, and it's a story that over the next many days is definitely one that hopefully will be written time and again, because when you have millions of people trying to figure out if something is good for them or bad for them to make an informed decision, it sure helps have good information about what it all actually means for you. And the website has been criticized as being clunky and not very user-friendly, so it's an opportunity for reporters, if I may say so, to jump in and really try to explain to people what it all means for them. And
yeah.
you know, how this could get better going in the future, because the website today shouldn't necessarily be what the website's going to be 2 months or 3 months from now.
And quick question from Mari over email. She says, I worry that the Republicans' hostage-taking in these negotiations is beginning to include other issues besides health care. That seems to be the Tea Party's concern, but other Republicans want to weaken Social Security and other earned benefits by instituting the change CPI. Democrats may now think these benefits are reasonable bargaining issues. Well, President Obama said Social Security is on the table a few months back. So, Josh, is this a real concern?
I think this is always a concern. I don't think it's a concern in terms of, well, it is somewhat of a concern. I'm not terribly worried right now about a grand bargain being used to resolve the current standoff. It seems like there is more unity among Democratic lawmakers in Congress and the White House on the issue of not lurching from crisis to crisis and hostage-taking situation to hostage-taking situation. What they've said, and this has been a fairly unified message, we will talk about all of these things. We're happy to negotiate budgetary matters, et cetera, but only after we get the government running again and deal with the debt limit. So I think that the political landscape is very different now than it was in 2011 when the administration was pushing very hard for a so-called grand bargain. And I think that, again, now they see this as a must-win situation in order to preserve the balance of power between the White House and Congress.
All right. And also, we didn't get to talk about this, but the Washington Post has a great piece about the medical device tax, which is supposed to fund part of the health care plan. And some Democrats oppose it because they live in states with medical device companies. So check that out. Joshua Holland is senior digital producer at BillMoyers.com. Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Thank you both for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. It's been 2 years since the Occupy movement launched. Where is the movement today, and what have activists learned? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the evolution of the Occupy Wall Street movement. In September 2011, tens of thousands of people took over public spaces from New York to Oakland, giving birth to the 1% slogan. So how did it change the conversation about wealth inequality, and where is the movement today? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
When the volcanic island of Thera detonates 75 miles to the north, it's as if something has convulsed the horizon and churned the bowl of sky above.
The end of the world, this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
Selected Shorts, Sunday evening, 5 o'clock, right here on local public radio, KALW San Francisco. Online at kalw.org. Next, from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say, and following that at noon, the Tavis Smiley Show. This is KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say, and this is where our conversation begins.
I saw people jump to sea, and people start dying one by one. After a week, more people die in the boat.
Divers are continuing to search and retrieve bodies from the sea after a boat carrying migrants sank off the coast of Lampedusa. More than 100 bodies have been recovered so far. We'll speak to migrants, two of which travelled from Afghanistan as children. They passed through six countries to get to the UK, one of them inside an empty fuel tanker. We'll ask, is it worth the risk? Plus, is Miley Cyrus being exploited by the music industry? Sinead O'Connor's open letter to her says riding a wrecking ball naked and licking a sledgehammer sends out a message that it's cool to be prostituted. We'll ask teenagers if she's got a point.
BBC News with Julie Candler. The veteran Vietnamese general credited with the defeat of French colonial forces and the Americans has died at the age of 102. General Vo Nguyen Giap joined the Communist Party in its early years and went on to become a national hero, second only to the party leader Ho Chi Minh. Here's our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head.
Vo Nguyen Giap joined Ho Chi Minh's struggle against French colonial rule in the 1930s. He commanded a homegrown guerrilla army, first against occupying Japanese forces, and then after 1945, against the returning French. In 1954, he stunned the world by inflicting a decisive defeat on a well-fortified French position at Dien Bien Phu. That battle showed that even the greatest European powers could be beaten by a poorly equipped Third World Army. After the French withdrawal, General Giap masterminded the campaign against American forces. He built a reputation as a brilliant but ruthless commander.
Egyptian security forces have dispersed hundreds of Islamist protesters in Cairo with tear gas and by firing live ammunition over their heads. The protesters were trying to make their way towards Tahrir Square. Here's our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
The security forces were well prepared with armoured vehicles, barbed wire and tear gas to stop the protesters from reaching Tahrir Square. With an evening curfew in place, the protests in Cairo have now largely dispersed. But the protesters have set this Sunday, the 40th anniversary of the 1973 war with Israel, as the day to try to mobilise people en masse against what they see as the military coup that removed the Islamist President Mohamed Morsi from power. The authorities have ordered Tahrir Square closed until Monday to prevent a possibly bigger flashpoint than today's protests, which seemed aimed at testing the waters ahead of Sunday.
Divers have suspended until tomorrow the search for the bodies of migrants who died when their boat capsized less than a kilometre off the Italian island of Lampedusa. More than 100 bodies have been recovered so far, but the final number of dead is likely to be more than twice that. The search has been hampered by rough seas. Dozens of people have been found guilty in a landmark corruption case in the Spanish coastal resort city of Marbella. Two of the city's former mayors and many other officials were given prison sentences for fraud and money laundering. Tom Burridge reports from Madrid.
The 85 men and women accused, including former mayors and local government officials of Marbella, a wealthy coastal city popular with tourists, sat in a court in southern Spain as a judge read out the verdicts in what is reportedly the biggest case of local political corruption in Spanish history. The majority of those present were found guilty, including Juan Antonio Roca, an unelected official who managed the city's planning department in the 1990s.
World News from the BBC. There have been more demonstrations in the Sudanese capital Khartoum, despite the heavy presence of security forces. Hundreds of anti-government protesters gathered after Friday prayers calling for freedom. Dozens of people have been killed and hundreds arrested since protests over fuel subsidy cuts started 10 days ago. The government of Madagascar has appealed for calm and ordered an overnight curfew on the resort island of Nosy Bay, where two Europeans and a local man were burned to death on Thursday. The men were attacked by a mob who suspected them of trafficking human organs for witchcraft, following the discovery of a child's body with his tongue and genitals cut out. One of the dead men was from France, the other had both Italian and French passports. An Italian Senate committee has voted to press ahead with a process that could soon lead to the former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's expulsion from Parliament. The vote follows his recent court conviction for tax fraud. Alan Johnston reports from Rome.
Any Italian MP convicted of a serious offence is liable to be flung out of Parliament, and that may well now happen to Mr. Berlusconi. He's poured everything into an effort to derail the expulsion process. But a Senate committee has just rejected his arguments. And if its decision is endorsed by the whole Senate in the weeks ahead, Mr. Berlusconi would be barred from holding public office. That would be a major humiliation for the former Prime Minister.
An American prisoner just released from jail after 41 years in solitary confinement has died of cancer. Herman Wallace, who was 71, passed away on Friday morning in Louisiana. He was freed on Tuesday after a federal judge ruled that his conviction for the murder of a prison guard had violated his right to a fair trial. Mr. Wallace maintained his innocence until his death, arguing that he was framed because of his links to the militant Black Panther movement. BBC News.
Hi, this is Dawood Azami from BBC Afghanstream. Welcome to World Have Your Say.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to the programme. We'll begin with the harrowing scenes from Lampedusa as divers continue to search and retrieve bodies from the sea after a boat carrying migrants sank off the coast. More than 100 bodies have been recovered, 200 are still missing. The morgue has been so overwhelmed a nearby aircraft hangar is housing rows and rows of bodies. And it's not an isolated incident. On the same day, local media reported that around 200 migrants were escorted to Sicily when their boat got into difficulties. And earlier this week, 13 migrants died also trying to reach the island. Well, Italy's Deputy Prime Minister has said this is not an Italian tragedy, this is a European tragedy, with Lampedusa being the gateway to Europe from Africa. But while there is desperation and poverty and the lure of a better life in Europe, what will stop these people taking these treacherous journeys? We'll hear from migrants from Eritrea and Afghanistan, some who travelled to the UK as children. One, as a 12-year-old boy, travelled through 10 countries alone. Another spent 4 months travelling in transport, varying from a tractor to the inside of an empty fuel tanker. We'll ask them if it was worth the risk. Wherever you're listening, you're welcome to get involved.
Find out more about World Have Your Say.
bbc.com/World Have Your Say.
And you can tweet questions to our guests throughout the programme using the hashtag WHYS. We're joined by Jalaluddin, who came to the UK 10 years ago from Afghanistan. Also Gulwali, who is also from Afghanistan, and both now residing in the UK. Welcome both of you to World Have Your Say. And I want to introduce you to Nezreddin, who is an Eritrean migrant who took the journey to the UK, has now claimed asylum here. And Nezreddin's sitting with me here in the World Have Your Say studio. You were on our edition, our World Have Your Say edition on TV earlier, so I appreciate you hanging around to speak with us now.
Thank you.
Tell me your story. First of all, why did you decide that you wanted to leave Eritrea and head to London?
Because I was not trying to come to London particularly. I just was want to go out and to a safer place. Then it went ongoing, this journey, because when I first arrived in Sudan, it was not safe for me. I became more desperate to go out of Sudan again. And then I went to Libya. In Libya, the same thing. They have their own problem, and everything got more tougher to me. So I have to go out from Libya as well. So I start taking the journey to come to Italy. Then in Italy, I also claimed asylum, but as you know, Italy, the government and all the humanitarian groups that work there doesn't seem to do their job properly. So I decided to come to UK. So when I first decided to go abroad, I didn't decide to go to Europe or any other because that choice was. It's a privilege to choose where you're going to when you don't have anything.
When you left Eritrea, did you know where you were going to head to, or was it literally, let's get to Sudan and then decide?
I remember it now. When I was in Eritrea, I saw Sudan as a heaven. Because when people told me, like, even some of them, they say to me, like, they live on the border of Eritrea and Sudan. Just to think that they live on the border and they can cross it easily, for me, was like a pass to heaven.
I know you don't want to go into the details of how you went from Eritrea to Sudan, but it did involve a journey on foot?
Yeah, 5 days on foot. I work without food or one plastic bottle of water, three of us.